Van Eck's office. Since when did the sun setting take so long? He could tell himself his father was fine as much as he wanted, but he wouldn't believe it until he saw Colm Fahey's craggy face for himself. At last, night fell, and a long hour later, the big bottle boat slid up to the dock at Van Eck's elegant boathouse.
"They made it!"
Weiland whooped. Kaz released a slow breath. Jesper grabbed a lantern and the champagne they'd been chilling. They bounded across the garden, tore open the door, and streamed into the boathouse. Their greetings died on their lips. Inej and Rati were helping Kuei from the bottle boat. Though he looked rumpled and shaky, and his shirt hung open to reveal a chest still spattered with pig's blood, he was in one piece. Jesper's father sat in the boat, his shoulders slumped, looking wearier than Jesper had ever seen him. His freckled face creased with sadness. He rose slowly and climbed onto the dock. He clutched Jesper tightly and said,
"You're all right. You're all right."
Nina remained in the boat, resting her head on Matthias's chest. He was laid out beside her, his eyes closed, his color ashen. Jesper cast Inej a questioning look. Her face was tear-stained. She gave a single shake of her head.
"How?"
Kaz said quietly. Fresh tears gathered in Inej's eyes.
"We still don't know."
Weiland retrieved a blanket from the house, and they spread it in the corner of the boathouse. Then Jesper and Rati helped lift Matthias's massive body out of the boat. The process was awkward, undignified. Jesper couldn't help but think the Fjärden would have hated that. They laid him down on the blanket. Nina sat beside him, saying nothing. His hand clutched in hers. Inej brought a shawl that she tucked over Nina's arms, then crouched silently next to her, head nestled against her shoulder. For a while, none of them knew what to do. But eventually, Kaz looked at his watch and signaled silently to them. There was still work that required their attention. They set about converting the bottle boat. By 10 bells, it needed to look less like a merchant's canal shop and more like a bodyman's sick boat. They'd remade crafts many times, using the base of a single vessel as the skeleton for a flour barge, a fishing vessel, a floating market stall, whatever was necessary for the job. This was an easier transformation. Nothing had to be built, only stripped away. They lugged the flats of bottles into the house and tore up the top part of the deck to eliminate the storage compartments, making the boat wider and flatter. Colm helped, working side by side with Jesper as they'd done back at the farm. Kuei drifted between the garden and the boathouse, still weak from his ordeal. Soon, Jesper was sweating, trying to focus on the rhythm of the work, but he couldn't shake the sadness in his heart. He'd lost friends. He'd been on jobs when things had gone wrong. Why did this feel so different? When the last of the work was finished, Weiland, Kaz, Rati, Jesper, and his father stood in the garden. There was nothing left to do. The barge was ready. Rati was dressed head to toe in black, and they'd fashioned a bodyman's hood by tearing apart and restitching one of Van Eck's fine black suits. It was time to go, but none of them moved. All around, Jesper could smell spring, sweet and eager, the scent of lilies and hyacinths, early blooming roses.
"We were all supposed to make it,"
said Weiland, softly. Maybe that was naive. The protest of a rich merchant's son who'd only had a taste of barrel life. But Jesper realized he'd been thinking the same thing. After all their mad escapes and close calls, he'd started to believe the six of them were somehow charmed. That his guns, Kaz's brains, Nina's wit, Inej's talent, Weiland's ingenuity, and Matthias's strength had made them somehow untouchable. They might suffer. They might take their knocks. But Weiland was right. In the end, They were all supposed to stay standing.
No mourners,
said Jesper, surprised by the ache of tears in his throat.
No funerals,
they all replied, softly.
Go on now,
said Calm.
Say your goodbyes.
They walked down to the boathouse, but before Wyland entered, he bent and plucked a red tulip from its bed. They all followed suit and silently filed inside. One by one, they knelt by Nina and rested a flower upon Matthias's chest, then stood, surrounding his body, as if now that it was too late, they might protect him. Kue was the last. There were tears in his golden eyes, and Jesper was glad he'd joined their circle. Matthias was the reason Kue and Jesper had survived the ambush on Black Vale. He was one of the reasons Kue would have a chance to truly live as a Grisha in Ravka. Nina turned her face to the water, looking out at the narrow houses that lined the Geld Canal. Jesper saw that the residents had filled their windows with candles, as if these small gestures might somehow push back the dark.
I'm pretending those lights are for him, she said.
She plucked a stray red petal from Matthias's chest, sighed, and released his hand, rising slowly.
I know it's time.
Jesper put his arm around her.
He loved you so much, Nina. Loving you made him better. Did it make a difference in the end?
Of course it did, said Inej. Matthias and I didn't pray to the same God, but we knew there was something beyond this life. He went easier to the next world, knowing he'd done good in this one.
Will you stay in Ravka? Asked Wylan. Only long enough to arrange transport to Fjerda. There are Grisha who can help me preserve his body for the journey, but I can't go home. I can't rest until he does. I'll take him north, to the ice. I'll bury him near the shore.
She turned to them then, as if seeing them for the first time.
What about all of you?
We'll have to figure out a way to spend our money, said Kaz.
What money? Said Jesper. It all got poured into the shoe coffers like they needed it.
Did it?
Nina's eyes narrowed, and Jesper saw a bit of her spirit return.
Stop playing around, Brekka, or I'll send my unholy army of the dead after you.
Kaz shrugged.
I felt the shoe could manage with 40 million.
The 30 million Vanek owed us, murmured Jesper.
4 million Kruger each.
I'm giving Per Haskell's share to Rotti and Spect. It will be laundered through one of the dregs' businesses before it passes back through the Gemmons Bank. But the funds should be in separate accounts for you by the end of the month.
He paused.
Matthias's share will go to Nina. I know money doesn't matter to...
It matters, said Nina. I'll find a way to make it matter. What will you do with your shares?
Find a ship, said Inej.
Put together a crew.
Help run an empire, said Jesper.
Try not to run it into the ground, said Wylan.
And you, Kaz? Nina asked.
Build something new, he said with a shrug. Watch it burn.
Jesper braced himself and said,
Actually, you should put my share in my father's name. I don't think I'm ready for that kind of money just yet.
Kaz watched him for a long moment.
That's the right move, Jess.
It was a little like forgiveness. Jesper felt sorrow dragging at his heart. He was flush with funds for the first time in years. His father's farm was safe, but none of it felt right.
I thought being rich would make everything better, he said.
Wyland glanced back at his father's mansion. I could have told you it doesn't work that way. In the distance, bells began to chime. Jesper went to get his father from the garden. Colm stood near the steps of the house, crumpled hat in his hands.
At least now we can afford to get you a new hat, said Jesper.
This one's comfortable.
I'll come home, Da, when the city is open again, after Wyland gets settled.
He's a good lad.
Too good for me, thought Jesper.
I hope you really will come home to visit.
Colm looked down at his big hands.
You should meet your mother's people. The girl your mother saved all those years ago.
I've heard she's very powerful. Jesper didn't know what to say.
I'd like that. I'm sorry for all of this, for getting you mixed up in it, for almost losing what you worked so hard to build. I guess what I mean is, this action will have no echo.
Pardon?
It sounds better in Sully. I'm going to try, Da. You're my son, Jesper. I can't protect you. Maybe I shouldn't have tried. But I will be there, even when you falter. Every time.
Jesper hugged his father tight. Remember this feeling, he told himself. Remember all you have to lose. He didn't know if he was strong enough to keep the promises he'd made tonight. But he could try to be. They walked back down to the boathouse and joined the others. Inej placed her hands on Nina's shoulders.
We'll see each other again.
Of course we will.
You've saved my life. I've saved yours.
I think you're ahead on that count. No, I don't mean in the big ways. Nina's eyes took them all in. I mean the little rescues. Laughing at my jokes, forgiving me when I was foolish. Never trying to make me feel small. It doesn't matter if it's next month, or next year, or 10 years from now. Those will be the things I remember when I see you again.
Kaz offered his gloved hand to Nina.
Until then, Zenek.
Count on it, Brekka.
They shook. Rati climbed down into the sick boat.
Ready?
Kuwe turned to Jesper.
You should visit me in Ravka. We could learn to use our powers together.
How about I push you in the canal and we see if you know how to swim?
Wyland said, with a very passable imitation of Kaz's glare.
Jesper shrugged. I've heard he's one of the richest men in Ketterdam. I wouldn't cross him. Kuwe gave an affronted sniff and lowered himself onto the floor of the sick boat.
He folded his arms neatly over his chest.
No, said Kaz. No. The bodymen don't bother to arrange them.
Kuwe let his hands flop to the sides. Colm was next, and Jesper instantly wanted to forget the image of his father laid out like a corpse. They used the blanket to lift Matthias onto the boat, then slid the fabric from beneath him. Nina took the clutch of tulips from his chest and scattered them on the water. She lay down beside him. Rati pushed the long wooden pole against the sandy bottom of the canal. The barge drifted away from the dock. In the dark, he looked like any other body man, ferrying his grim cargo through the canals. Only the sick boats could pass freely through the city and out of the harbor, collecting the dead to take to the Reaper's barge for burning.
Rati would bring them up through the manufacturing district, where the Grisha refugees had fled after the auction, after discarding the blue robes they'd worn to pretend to be the Council of Tides. Kaz had known there was no way to transport that many Grisha without attracting notice.
So they'd taken the secret passage from the embassy to the tavern, and then paraded down the street in billowing blue robes, faces shrouded in mist, declaring their power instead of attempting to hide it. Jesper supposed there was a lesson there if he wanted to take it. There were only 4 real Tidemakers among them, but it had been enough. Of course, there had been the chance the real Council of Tides would show up at the auction, but based on their record, Kaz had thought it was worth the risk.
The Grisha and Sturmhand would be waiting to board the boat not far from Sweet Reef. Once they were all aboard, Rati would pull them out past the harbor and then send up a flare where Sturmhand's ship would come to meet them. It was the only way to get a group of refugee Grisha, a farmer who'd helped con the entire merchant council,
and the body of a boy who had until a few hours ago been the most wanted hostage in the world, out of the city.
You'll have to be still, Inej murmured.
Still as the grave, Nina replied.
The barge slid into the canal, and she lifted her hand in farewell. her palm like a white star bright against the dark. They stood by the water's edge long after it had faded. At some point, Jesper realized Kaz was gone. "Not one for goodbyes, is he?" he muttered.
"He doesn't say goodbye," Inez said.
She kept her eyes on the lights of the canal. Somewhere in the garden, a night bird began to sing.
"He just lets go."
43. Kaz. Kaz propped his bad leg on a low stool and listened as Annika gave her report on the earnings at the Crow Club and the status of tourist traffic on East Stave. In the 3 weeks since Kuwe's auction and the plague panic, Kaz had taken over Per Haskell's office on the ground floor of the slat. He still slept on the top floor, but it was easier to do business from Haskell's lair. He didn't miss the extra trips up and down the stairs, and his old office felt empty now. Whenever he sat down to try to get some work done, he'd find his eyes straying to the window ledge. The city still hadn't returned to normal, but that had created some interesting opportunities. Prices on the staves had dropped as people prepared for a long plague outbreak, and Kaz was quick to take advantage. He bought the building next to the Crow Club so that they could expand, and he even managed to acquire a small property on the lid. When the panic was over and tourism resumed, Kaz was looking forward to fleecing a far higher class of pigeon. He'd also bought out Per Haskell's shares in the Crow Club for a reasonable price. He could have had them for nothing, given the trouble in the barrel, but he didn't want anyone feeling too sorry for the old man. When Pekka Rollins returned to the city, Kaz would find a way to cut him out of the business. The last thing he wanted was for the proceeds of his hard work to go into Rollins' coffers. Once Annika finished her recital, Pim gave the details he'd gathered on Van Eck's trial. The mysterious Johannes Rietveld had not been found, but once Van Eck's accounts had been laid bare, it had quickly become clear he'd been using the information he'd learned on the Merchant Council to buy up Gerda Farms. Beyond swindling his friends, tampering with an auction, and kidnapping his own son, there were even suggestions that he'd hired a team to break into a Fjerdin government building and possibly sabotage his own sugar silos. Van Eck was not out on bail. In fact, it didn't look like he'd be out of jail any time soon. Though his son had provided a small fund for his legal representation, it could be described as moderate at best. Weiland had chosen to use a portion of his newfound wealth to restore his home. He'd given Jesper a small allowance to speculate in the markets, and he'd brought his mother home as well. People in the Geldstraat were shocked to see Maria Hendricks sitting in the park with her son, or being rowed down the canal by one of their servants. Sometimes they could be glimpsed from the water, standing before their easels in the Van Eck garden. Alice had stayed with them for a time, but eventually she and her terrier had chosen to escape the city and its gossip. She would finish her confinement in the Hendricks Lake House, and was said to be making dubious progress in her singing lessons. Kaz was just glad he didn't live next door. "That's good work," Kaz said when Pim had finished. He hadn't thought Pim had much talent for gathering intelligence.
"Roder put together the report," Pim said. "Think he's gunning for a place as your new spider."
"I don't need a new spider," said Kaz. Pim shrugged.
"Wraith's been scarce. People talk."
Kaz dismissed Annika and Pim, and sat for a long moment in the quiet office. He'd barely slept in the past few weeks. He'd been waiting nearly half his life for this moment to become a reality, and he was afraid that if he let himself sleep, it might all vanish. Pekka Rollins had fled the city and hadn't returned. Word was he'd holed up with his son in a country house surrounded by armed men at all times. Between the quarantines at the Emerald Palace, the Kalish Prince, and the sweet shop, and the fact that he wasn't around to put things to rights, Pekka Rollins' businesses were on the brink of collapse. There was even talk of mutiny within the Dime Lions. Their boss was gone, and the deal he'd made with Van Eck had made them look no better than a rich man's henchman. They might as well be Stodwatch. Brick by brick. Eventually, Rollins would dig himself out of the rubble. Kaz would have to be ready. A knock sounded at the door. The one problem with being on the ground floor was that people were a lot more likely to bother you.
Letter came, Annika said, and tossed it on his desk. Looks like you're keeping fast company, Brecker, she said with a sly smile.
Kaz let his glance at the door do the talking. He wasn't interested in watching Annika bat her yellow lashes.
Right, she said, and vanished, closing the door behind her.
Kaz held the letter up to the light. The seal was pale blue wax, marked with a golden double eagle. He slit open the envelope, read the letter's contents, and burned both. Then he wrote a note of his own and sealed it in black wax. Kaz knew Inej had been staying at Weiland's house. Occasionally, he'd find a scrawled note on his desk. Some bit of information about Pekka, or the doings at the Stadthall. And he'd know she'd been here in his office. He slipped on his coat, took up his hat and cane, and tucked the paper into his pocket. He could have sent a messenger, but he wanted to deliver this note himself. Kaz strode past Annika and Pim on the way out of the slat. I'll be back in an hour, he said. And I better not still see you podges wasting your time here.
Hardly anyone at the club, said Pim. Tourists are too scared of the plague.
Go to the rooming houses where all the frightened pigeons are waiting out the panic. Show them you're in the pink of health. Make sure they know you just had a fine time playing three-man bramble at the Crow Club. If that doesn't work, get your asses to the harbors and drum up some pigeons from the workers on the boats.
I just came off a shift, protested Pim.
Kaz settled his hat on his head and ran a thumb over the brim.
Didn't ask.
He cut east through the city. He was tempted to take a detour, just to see for himself how things were proceeding on West Stave. Between the shoe attack and the plague outbreak, the pleasure houses were practically deserted. Several streets had been barricaded to enforce the quarantine surrounding the sweet shop and the menagerie. Rumor had it, Helene Van Houden wasn't going to make her rent that month.
A pity.
There were no browboats operating, so he had to make the journey up to the financial district on foot. As he wended his way along a small, deserted canal, he saw a thick mist rising off the water. Only a few steps later, it was so dense he could barely see. The mist clung to his coat, wet and heavy, thoroughly out of place on a warm spring day. Kaz paused on the low bridge that spanned the canal, waiting, cane at the ready. A moment later, three hooded figures emerged to his left. Three more appeared to his right, their blue cloaks moving sinuously through the air, though there was no breeze. That much Kaz had gotten right. But their masks weren't made of mist. Instead, the real Council of Tides, or a very convincing set of pretenders, wore something that gave the impression of looking into a starry night sky. Nice effect.
Kaz Brecker, said the lead tide maker. Where is Kuwe Yulbo?
Dead and gone. Burnt to ashes on the Reaper's barge.
Where is the real Kuwe Yulbo?
Kaz shrugged.
A church full of people saw him get shot. A medic pronounced him dead. Beyond that, I can't help you.
You do not want the Council of Tides as an enemy, young man. None of your shipments will ever leave port again. We will flood Fifth Harbor.
By all means do. I don't own shares in Fifth Harbor anymore. You want to stop my shipments? You'll have to stop every boat coming in and out of the harbor. I'm not a merch. I don't charter ships and register trade manifests. I'm a thief and a smuggler. Try to catch hold of me, and you'll find you're trying to hold air.
Do you know how easy it is to drown?
Asked the tide maker.
He lifted a hand.
It can happen anywhere.
Suddenly, Kaz felt his lungs filling with water. He coughed, spat seawater, and bent double, gasping.
Tell us what we want to know, said the tide maker.
Kaz drew a stuttering breath.
I don't know where Kuwe Yulbo is. You can drown me where I stand and nothing will change that.
Then maybe we'll find your friends and drown them in their beds.
Kaz coughed and spat again.
and maybe you'll find the obelisk towers under plague quarantine. The tide shifted uneasily, the mists moving with them. I made those sirens sound. I created this plague, and I can control it. A bluff, said the tide maker, his sleeve gliding through the mist. Try me. I'll spread sickness around every one of your towers. They'll become epicenters of disease. You think the Merchant Council won't lock you all down? Demand you finally register your identities? They'll probably be happy for the excuse. They wouldn't dare. This country would sink were it not for us. They won't have a choice. The public will clamor for action. They'll burn the towers from the ground up. Monstrous boy. Kedredam is made of monsters. I just happen to have the longest teeth. The secret of Jirda Parem can never be revealed to the world. No Grisha would ever be safe again. Not here. Not anywhere. And it's lucky for you it died with that poor shoe kid. We won't forget this, Kazbrekker. One day you'll regret your insolence. Tell you what, said Kaz. When that day comes, mark it on your calendars. I can think of a lot of people who want to throw a party. The figures seemed to blur, and when the mists finally thinned, Kaz saw no trace of the tides. He shook his head and set off down the canal. That was the wonderful thing about Kedredam. It never let you get bored. No doubt the tides would want something from him in the future, and he'd be obliged to give it to them. But for now, he had unfinished business.
44. Inej. Inej didn't think she could make it up the stairs to bed. How had she whiled away so many hours at dinner with Jesper and Wylan? The cook had been all apologies as the meal was served that night. She still couldn't get quality fresh produce from the markets, what with people so afraid to come into the city. They'd done their best to reassure her and had stuffed themselves on cheese and leek pie, then eaten honey-soaked cakes while sitting on the music room floor. Wylan's mother had retired early. She seemed to be coming back to herself in fits and starts, but Inej suspected it would be a long road. Wylan played the piano and Jesper sang the dirtiest sea shanty Inej had ever heard. She missed Nina painfully. There had been no letters, and she could only hope her friend had made it to Fjarda safely and found some peace on the ice. When Inej finally had her ship, maybe her first trip would be to Ravka. She could journey inland to Os Alta, try to find her family on one of the old routes they'd traveled. See Nina again. Someday. Inej had chosen to spend her nights at Wyland's house, returning to the slat just to fetch her few belongings. With her contract paid and her bank account brimming with funds, she wasn't entirely sure where she belonged. She'd been researching sailing vessels with heavy cannon, and using her knowledge of the city's secrets to begin gathering information that she hoped would lead her to the slavers who did business through the ports of Kerch. The skills she'd acquired as the Wraith would serve her well. But tonight, all she wanted to contemplate was sleep. She dragged herself up the stairs and crawled into her deliciously comfortable bed. Only when she'd reached over to turn down the lamp did she see the note. A sealed letter in Kaz's messy scrawl. Sunrise. Fifth Harbor. Of course, he'd managed to get into the locked house, past the servants and the three fools singing at the top of their lungs. It was only fair, she supposed. She'd been coming and going at the slat, slipping in and out of windows and doorways, leaving bits of information for Kaz when she needed to. She could have simply knocked on his office door, but it was easier this way. Kaz had changed. The net. Paying her contract. She could still feel the faint touch of his lips on her skin. His bare hands fumbling with the knots of her bandages. Inej had seen the scant glimmer of what he might become if he let himself. She couldn't bear to see him dressed in armor once more, buttoned back into his immaculate suits and cold demeanor. She wouldn't listen to him talk as if the ice court and everything that came after had been just another job, another score, another bit of advantage to be gained. But she wouldn't ignore his note. It was time to put an end to this thing that had never had a chance to begin. She'd tell him what she'd heard about Pekka. Offer to share some of her roots and hiding spots with Rhoder. It would be over. She turned down the light, and after a long while she fell asleep with the note clutched in her hand. It was hard to force herself from bed the next morning. She'd developed bad habits in the last 3 weeks, sleeping when she wanted to, eating when she liked. Nina would be proud. Being at Weiland's house felt like she'd entered some kind of enchanted world. She'd been to the house before when she and Kaz had stolen the decouple, and then again before the sweet reef job. But it was one thing to be a thief in a house, and quite another to be a guest. Inej found herself embarrassed by the pleasure of being waited on, and yet Vanek's staff seemed glad to have them there. Maybe they'd feared Weiland would close up the house and they'd all lose their employment. Or maybe they thought Weiland deserved some kindness. One of the maids had set out a lapis silk robe and a little pair of fur-lined slippers by the side of the bed. There was hot water in the pitcher by the basin, a glass bowl full of fresh roses. She washed, brushed out her hair, rebraided it, then dressed and quietly let herself out of the house, through the front door, of all things. She kept her hood up and moved swiftly as she made her way to the harbor. The streets were still largely empty, especially at this hour of the morning, but Inej knew she could not let down her guard. Pekka Rollins was gone, Vanek was in jail, but contracted to the dregs or not. As long as Kaz had enemies on these streets, she did too. He was standing on the quay looking out at the water. His black coat fit snugly across his shoulders, the salt wind off the sea ruffling the dark waves of his hair. She knew she did not have to announce herself, so she stood next to him, taking in the view of the boats on the docks. It looked like several vessels had arrived that morning. Maybe the city was regaining its rhythm. "How are things at the house?" he asked at last. "Comfortable," she admitted. "It's made me lazy." For the briefest moment, Inej wondered if Kaz might be jealous of that comfort, or if it was simply alien to him. Would he ever let himself rest? Sleep in? Linger over a meal? She would never know. "I hear Weiland is letting Jesper play the markets." "Very cautiously, and with extremely limited sums. Weiland's hoping to channel his love of risk into something productive." "It might work brilliantly, or it could end in total disaster, but that's generally the way Jesper likes to work. At least the odds are better than in any gambling hall." Weiland only agreed after Jesper promised to start training with a fabricator. "Assuming they can find one. It might take a trip to Rovka." Kaz tilted his head, watching a gull arc above them, wings spread wide. "Tell Jesper he's missed. Around the slat." Inej raised a brow. "Around the slat." From Kaz, that was as good as a bouquet of flowers and a heartfelt hug. And it would mean the world to Jesper. Part of her wanted to draw this moment out, to be near him a while longer, listen to the rough burr of his voice, or just stand there in easy silence, as they'd done countless times before. He had been so much of her world for so long. Instead, she said, "What business, Kaz? You can't be planning a new job so soon." "Here," he said, handing her a long glass. With a jolt, she realized he wasn't wearing his gloves. She took it from him tentatively. Inej put the long glass to her eye and peered out at the harbor. "I don't know what I'm looking for." "Berth 22. Inej adjusted the lens and scanned along the docks. There, in the very berth from which they'd set out for the ice court, was a tidy little warship. She was sleek and perfectly proportioned, cannons out, a flag bearing the three Kerch fishes flying stiffly from the mainmast. On her side, spelled out in graceful white script, were the words, "The Wraith." Inej's heart stuttered. It couldn't be. "That's not..."
"She's yours," said Kaz. "I've asked Speck to help you hire on the right crew. If you'd prefer to take on a different first mate, he..."
"Kaz..."
"Weiland gave me a good price. His father's fleet is full of worthy ships, but that one, it suited you."
He looked down at his boots.
"That berth belongs to you, too. It will always be there when... if you want to come back.
Inej could not speak. Her heart felt too full. A dry creek bed, ill-prepared for such rain.
I don't know what to say.
His bare hand flexed on the crow's head of his cane. The sight was so strange, Inej had trouble tearing her eyes from it.
Say you'll return.
I'm not done with Ketterdam. She hadn't known she meant it until she'd said the words. Kaz cast her a swift glance.
I thought you wanted to hunt slavers.
I do. And I want your help. Inej licked her lips, tasted the ocean on them. Her life had been a series of impossible moments. So why not ask for something impossible now?
It's not just the slavers. It's the procurers, the customers, the barrel bosses, the politicians. It's everyone who turns a blind eye to suffering when there's money to be made. I'm a barrel boss.
You would never sell someone, Kaz. You know better than anyone that you're not just one more boss scraping for the best margin.
The bosses, the customers, the politicians, he mused. That could be half the people in Ketterdam. And you want to fight them all?
Why not? Inej asked. On the seas and in the city, one by one.
Brick by brick, he said.
Then he gave a single shake of his head as if shrugging off the notion.
I wasn't made to be a hero, Wraith. You should have learned that by now. You want me to be the better man. A good man.
This city doesn't need a good man. It needs you.
Inej,
how many times have you told me you're a monster? So be a monster. Be the thing they all fear when they close their eyes at night. We don't go after all the gangs. We don't shut down the houses that treat fairly with their employees. We go after women like Tanta Helene, men like Pekka Rollins. She paused. And think about it this way. You'll be thinning the competition. He made a sound that might almost have been a laugh. One of his hands balanced on his cane. The other rested at his side next to her. She'd need only move the smallest amount and they would be touching. He was that close. He was that far from reach. Cautiously, she let her knuckles brush against his. A slight weight. A bird's feather. He stiffened, but he didn't pull away.
I'm not ready to give up on this city, Kaz. I think it's worth saving.
I think you're worth saving. Once they'd stood on the deck of a ship, and she'd waited just like this. He had not spoken then, and he did not speak now. Inej felt him slipping away, dragged under, caught in an undertow that would take him farther and farther from shore. She understood suffering, and she knew it was a place she could not follow. Not unless she wanted to drown, too. Back on Black Vale, he told her they would fight their way out.
Knives drawn, pistols blazing, because that's what we do.
She would fight for him, but she could not heal him. She would not waste her life trying. She felt his knuckles slide against hers. Then his hand was in her hand. His palm was pressed against her own. A tremor moved through him. Slowly he let their fingers entwine. For a long while they stood there, hands clasped, looking out at the gray expanse of the sea. A Ravkin ship flying the Lansov Double Eagle had docked only a few berths over from the Wraith, probably unloading a cargo of tourists or immigrants seeking work. The world changed. The world went on.
Kaz, she asked suddenly. Why crows? The crow and cup. Probably because crows are scavengers. They take the leavings.
I don't mean the dregs tattoo. That's as old as the gang. Why did you adopt it? Your cane. The crow club. You could have chosen a new symbol, built a new myth. Kaz's bitter coffee eyes remained trained on the horizon, the rising sun painting him in pale gold light.
Crows remember human faces. They remember the people who feed them, who are kind to them, and the people who wrong them, too.
Really? He nodded slowly.
They don't forget. They tell each other who to look after and who to watch out for. Inej,
Kaz said, gesturing out to the harbor with the head of his cane.
Look.
She raised the long glass and peered back down at the harbor, at the passengers disembarking. But the image was blurry. Reluctantly, she released his hand. It felt like a promise, and she didn't want to let go. She adjusted the lens, and her gaze caught on two figures moving down the gangplank. Their steps were graceful, their posture straight as knife blades. They moved like Sully acrobats. She drew in a sharp breath. Everything in her focused like the lens of the long glass. Her mind refused the image before her. This could not be real. It was an illusion, a false reflection, a lie made in rainbow-hued glass. She would breathe again and it would shatter. She reached for Kaz's sleeve. She was going to fall. He had his arm around her, holding her up. Her mind split. Half of her was aware of his bare fingers on her sleeve, his dilated pupils, the brace of his body around hers. The other half was still trying to understand what she was seeing. His dark brows knitted together. I wasn't sure. Should I not have? She could barely hear him over the clamor in her heart. How? She said, her voice raw and strange with unshed tears. How did you find them?
A favor. From Sturmhand. He sent out scouts. As part of our deal. If it was a mistake.
No, she said, as the tears spilled over at last. It was not a mistake.
Of course, if something had gone wrong during the job, they'd be coming to retrieve your corpse.
Inej choked out a laugh. Just let me have this. She righted herself, her balance returning. Had she really thought the world didn't change, she was a fool. The world was made of miracles. Unexpected earthquakes, storms that came from nowhere and might reshape a continent. The boy beside her. The future before her. Anything was possible. Now Inej was shaking, her hands pressed to her mouth, watching them move up the dock toward the quay. She started forward, then turned back to Kaz. Come with me, she said. Come meet them. Kaz nodded as if steeling himself, flexed his fingers once more.
Wait,
he said. The burn of his voice was rougher than usual.
Is my tie straight?
Inej laughed, her hood falling back from her hair.
That's the laugh,
he murmured. But she was already setting off down the quay, her feet barely touching the ground. Mama, she called out. Papa! Inej saw them turn, saw her mother grip her father's arm. They were running toward her. Her heart was a river that carried her to the sea.
45. Pekka. Pekka sat in the front room of his country house, peering out from behind one of the white lace curtains. Kalish lace, imported from Maroc Glen. Pekka had spared no expense when he'd polished up this place. He'd built the house from the ground up, specifying the dimensions of every room, the varnish for the floors, choosing each fixture and furnishing with care. The Emerald Palace was his great pride, the Kalish prince, the crown jewel of his empire, a testament to luxury and style, decked out in the highest barrel flash. But this place was his home, his castle. Its every detail spoke respectability, prosperity, permanence. Pekka felt safe here. Safe with his son and the bodyguards he paid so well. Still, he moved away from the window. Best not to take any chances. Plenty of spots for a marksman to hide out there. Maybe he should cut down the beech trees that bordered the lawn. He struggled to understand where his life had gone. A month ago he'd been a rich man, a man to be reckoned with, a king. And now? He clutched his son closer and stroked his red hair. The boy was restless in his lap. I want to go play, Albi said, leaping from Pekka's knee, thumb in his mouth, clutching the soft little lion, one of the many he owned. Pekka could barely stand to look at the thing. Kaz Brekker had bluffed him, and he'd fallen for it. But it was worse than that. Brekker had gotten into his head. Pekka couldn't stop thinking of his boy, his perfect boy, buried beneath clods of earth, screaming for him, pleading for his father, and Pekka unable to come to his rescue. Sometimes his son was crying from somewhere in the fields, but he didn't know where to dig. Sometimes Pekka was the one lying in the grave, paralyzed as the earth was piled on top of him. Light, at first, a patter of rain, then in heavy clods that filled his mouth and stole the breath from his chest. Above him he could hear people laughing. Boys, girls, women, men. They were silhouettes against a blue dusk sky, their faces lost to shadow, but he knew who they were. All the people he'd swindled, duped, killed. All the sorry sobs he'd sacrificed as he made his climb up the ladder. He still couldn't remember the name of Brekker's brother. What had he been called? Pekka had been Jakob Hertzun. He'd worn 1,000 different faces, but Kaz Brekker had found him. He'd come for his revenge. If one of those fools could find him, why not another? And another. How many would stand in line to throw the next shovelful of dirt? Making choices, even simple choices, had become difficult. What tie to wear? What to order for dinner? He doubted himself. Pekka had never doubted himself. He'd started life as a no one. A stonebreaker from the Wandering Isle. A sturdy boy valued only for his strong back and his youth, for his ability to swing a pick and carry a load of rocks. But he'd cheated his way onto a boat coming to Ketterdam, and made his reputation with his fists. He'd been a boxer, a bruiser, the most feared enforcer in the gangs. He'd survived because he was the wiliest, the toughest, because no one could break his will. Now all he wanted to do was sit inside, drink his whiskey, watch the shadows move across the ceiling. Anything else filled him with a terrible fatigue. And then one morning he woke to a bright blue enamel sky. The air was full of birdsong. He could smell the arrival of summer, real heat in the air, fruit ripening in the orchard. He dressed. He breakfasted. He spent the morning in the fields, working in the early sun, and playing with Albie. When the day grew too hot, they sat on the wide porch and drank cool glasses of lemonade. Then Pekka went inside and actually faced the papers and bills that had been piling up on his desk. Things were in disastrous shape at the Emerald Palace and the Kalish Prince. They'd been closed by the city as a health precaution. The doors and windows marked with dire black X's to indicate an outbreak site. News from Ketterdam indicated that the plague had been a false alarm, some strange fungus or virus that had struck quickly but seemed to be proving harmless. City officials were cautiously optimistic. Pekka studied the balance sheets. Both gambling halls might be salvageable in time. He'd take a loss for the year, but once things had calmed down, he'd slap a new coat of paint on the buildings, give them new names, and he'd be back in business. He'd probably have to close the sweet shop. No man was going to pull his trousers down where the price might be catching the plague, not when there were so many other establishments willing to cater to him. That was unfortunate. But he'd had setbacks before. He had a good source for indentures who would work for nothing. He was still Pekka Rollins, king of the barrel. And if any of those little skivs roaming the streets had forgotten that fact, he'd be happy to serve them a reminder. By the time Pekka was done sorting through the masses of correspondence and news, night had fallen. He stretched, downed the last of his whiskey, and looked in on Albie sleeping soundly, with that cursed little lion tucked beneath his chin. He said goodnight to the guards, posted outside his son's bedroom, then made his way down the hall. "Turning in, boss?" asked Doty. He and another huge bruiser watched over Pekka's quarters at night, men Pekka knew he could trust. "I am, Doty, and a good night it'll be, too." When he climbed into bed, he knew he would not dream of his son crying, or the grave, or that dark chorus standing above him, laughing. Tonight, he'd dream of the Wandering Isle, of its rolling green fields and the mists that wreathed its mountains. In the morning, he would rise refreshed and restored, ready to see the real work of reclaiming his throne. Instead, he woke with the weight of a heavy rock on his chest. His first thought was of the grave, the weight of earth pressing down on him. Then he came back to himself. His bedroom was dark, and someone was on top of him. He gasped and tried to shove up from his sheets, but he felt a pair of knees and elbows locked onto him, the stinging press of a blade against his neck. "I'll kill you," Pecker gasped. "You already tried." A woman's voice. No, a girl's. He opened his mouth to bellow for his guards. She jabbed at his neck with the knife. Pecker hissed as blood trickled into his collar. "Scream, and I'll use this blade to pin your throat to the pillow. What do you want? Do you like life, Rollins?" When he didn't answer, she jabbed him again. "I asked you a question. Do you like life? How did you get past my guards? You call those guards? You killed them? I didn't bother. The only window is barred. I am the Wraith, Rollins. Do you think bars can stop me?" Brecker's little Sooley girl. He cursed the money he'd spent on that Ravkin mercenary. "So Brecker sent you to deliver a message?" he asked. "I have my own message to deliver. Tell me what deal you struck with Brecker. Whatever he's paying you, I can double it." "Shh," the girl said, pressing down with her knees. Pecker felt something in his shoulder pop. "I left pretty Dunyasha's brains dashed all over the Ketterdam cobblestones. I want you to think about what I could do to you. Why don't you just kill me now and save your threats?" He would not be cowed by some slip of a girl from the menagerie. "Death is a gift you haven't yet earned." "You..." She stuffed something in his mouth. "You can scream now," she crooned. She peeled back the fabric of his nightshirt, and then her knife was digging into his chest. He screamed around the gag, trying to buck her off. "Careful now," she said. "You wouldn't want me to slip." Pecker forced himself to still. He realized how long it had been since he'd felt real pain. No one had dared lift a hand against him in years. "Better." She sat back slightly, as if to review her work. Panting, Pecker peered down, but could see nothing. A wave of nausea rolled through him. "This was the first cut, Rollins. If you ever think about coming back to Ketterdam, we'll meet again, so I can make the second." She replaced his nightshirt with a little pat and was gone. He didn't hear her leave, only felt her weight release from his chest. He tore the rag from his mouth and rolled over, fumbling for the lamp. Light flooded the room, the dresser, the mirror, the washbasin. There was no one there. He stumbled to the window. It was still barred and locked. His chest burned where she'd used her knife on him. He lurched to his dressing table and yanked back his blood-soaked nightshirt. She'd made a precise slash directly above his heart. Blood spilled from it in thick, seeping pulses. This was the first cut. Bile rose in his throat. "All the saints and their mothers," he thought. "She's going to cut the heart from my chest." Pekka thought of Dunyasha, one of the most gifted assassins in the world, a creature without conscience or mercy, and the Wraith had bested her. Maybe she really wasn't entirely human. Albi. He crashed through the door into the hallway, past the guards still posted there. They came to attention, stunned expressions on their faces, but he raced past them, careening down the hall to his son's room. Please, he begged silently. Please, please, please. He threw the door open. Light from the hall spilled over the bed. Albie was on his side, sleeping soundly, his thumb tucked into his mouth. Pekka slumped against the door jamb, weak with relief, holding his nightshirt to his bleeding chest. Then he saw the toy his son was clutching in his arms. The lion was gone. In its place was a black-winged crow. Pekka recoiled, as if he'd seen his son asleep with his cheek on a hairy-legged spider. He shut the door gently and strode back down the hall. "Get Shay and Gerrigan out of bed," he said. "What happened?" asked Doty. "Should I call a medic? Tell him to start packing our bags, and gather up all the cash we have." "Where are we going?" "As far away as we can get." Rollins slammed the bedroom door behind him. He went back to his window and tested the bars again. Still solid, still locked. In the black shine of the glass he could see his reflection, and he didn't recognize himself. Who was this man with thinning hair and frightened eyes? There had been a time when he would have faced any threat with chin up and guns blazing. What had changed? Was it just time? No, he realized. It's success. He'd gotten comfortable, and found that he enjoyed it. Pekka sat before his mirror and began to wipe the blood from his chest. He'd taken pride in making Ketterdam his. He'd laid the traps, set the fires, put his boot to the necks of all those who'd challenged him, and reaped the rewards of his boldness. Most of the opposition had fallen, easy pickings. The occasional challenge almost welcome for the excitement it brought. He'd broken the barrel to his whim, written the rules of the game to his liking, rewritten them at will. The problem was that the creatures who had managed to survive the city he'd made were a new kind of misery entirely. Brekker, his wraith queen, his rotten little court of thugs. A fearless breed, hard-eyed and feral, hungrier for vengeance than for gore. "Do you like life, Rollins?" Yes, he did. Very much indeed. And he intended to go on living for a good long time. Pekka would count his money. He would raise his son. He'd find himself a good woman, or two, or ten. And maybe, in the quiet hours, he'd raise a glass to the men like him. To his fellow architects of misfortune, who had helped raise Brekker and his crew. He'd drink to the whole sorry lot of them. But mostly, to the poor fools who didn't know what trouble was coming.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Crooked Kingdom, written by Lee Bardugo. Performed by Kevin T. Collins, Peter Ganim, Lauren Fortgang, Elizabeth Evans, Jay Snyder, Brandon Rubin, Roger Clark, and Fred Berman. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright, 2016 by Lee Bardugo. Production copyright, 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc. If you enjoyed this audiobook, be sure to get more books in the Six of Crow series today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.